is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome to Medicine on Call. I have a special guest on today with me, Dr. Samuel Valeri. He's an ENT surgeon who works out of Arkansas. And I was intrigued, and I'm really happy to have him on because I saw his billboard online, and you're my hero because you're not just talking about it, you're about it. And I think there's two types of doctors that are coming to the fore. The ones that are happy, or maybe not, but are afraid to step out of the shadows and once again be advocates for their patients and be treated with the respect that we deserve as human beings and as professionals, and those that are not going to play the game, who want to practice medicine following the Hippocratic Oath, where it's patient-centered and it's about being an individual, first as an advocate for your patient and as a physician itself, or for the profession itself. And Dr. Samuel Valeri is one of the people who's done that. I mean, he has a solo practice, which in itself is unusual these days, and has decided to step out of the shadows of Medicare and all of the bells and whistles and strings attached that go along with it, and just say, I'm not going to do it anymore. I love what I do, and I'm going to treat my patients the way I train to treat them, and so be it. And I mean, I think if more doctors did what you're doing, we would actually get our profession back, and we would save the healthcare system. So I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your, I'm sure, busy schedule to come on my show today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. I know that you're an ENT surgeon, but what are your roots? Where were you born, and how'd you end up in ENT?
Well, I grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana. My father was a carpet layer, and my mother was an elementary school teacher, and I got married young. I was 20 years old, just turned 20 when I got married, and I went into my father's footsteps and was a carpet layer, and about a year after I got married, I decided I didn't want to do that the rest of my life, so I started into college, and somewhere along the line in college decided, well, maybe I'll be a dentist, and so I went in one day to talk to the dental school advisor. And he was not in, and next door was the medical school advisor. The medical school advisor said, well, why don't you come talk to me? And that's what I did, and I ended up going to medical school. And toward the end of medical school, I had a choice of either doing ear, nose, and throat surgery or neurosurgery, and I decided to do ear, nose, and throat surgery, and that's how I ended up in the specialty. And then at the end of my training, we moved to Arkansas, where I joined three private practice surgeons in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and that's where I've been ever since. And 3 years after I went into private practice with them, I went on my own, and so for the last 15 or 16 years, I've been by myself in a solo practice with just a few employees, and so that's where we are now.
That's pretty awesome, and I feel a kindred to that story because it sounds a lot like what happened with me. I know it's, you know, not to get personal or anything, but why did you leave the three-person group? I was in a 40-person group when I first left residency, and it was one of those, you know, you're part of a big group, you have to just produce and do procedures, and it just wasn't my style.
Same thing with me.
Okay.
Same thing with me. I just felt like I liked seeing all my patients by myself. I didn't like somebody else seeing my patients when I wasn't there, and I didn't like jumping in and seeing someone else's patients if they weren't there. Mm-hmm. So for me, with my practice style and the way that I like to treat my patients, I was just better off by myself and seeing all my patients every day on my own, and that was just the way I wanted to practice.
Did you get any pushback from your partners when you left? Before you left? Because it sounds
no,
like you weren't a
not
little
too
bit
much
ingrained.
Because
no?
they were older, and a couple of them were planning on retiring anyway, and one of them worked for about another 5 years, and so I didn't receive too much pushback from them.
So when you opened your practice, it started like about in the late 90s, correct?
Yes, it had been when I moved to town here in Hot Springs, it was 95, and so it was 98 when I went by myself.
So I want patients to really understand what that means when you go into private practice. I think there's we don't talk about our profession as physicians. We just, you know, work harder if it's hard, you know, see more patients, stay later. We just don't whine, basically. So what does it take to go on your own and open a solo practice, were you feeling pressure to enter insurance contracts, or did you?
Absolutely. When you're first starting out, you're scared to death that you're not going to make it. So your tendency is to basically just sign up with every insurance company that you can and try to get some patients that can come see you, because you've got tremendous expenses starting up. As you know, in ear, nose, and throat, you have all the equipment to buy, the chairs, the hearing testing equipment, hearing testing booth, and so it's a tremendous expense to start up. And I don't know what it would cost today for a single physician to go out and start up an ear, nose, and throat practice, but I suspect it would take $750,000 just in equipment and getting things ready to go before you saw your first patient.
Now, I made the mistake when I opened. I was under duress, and I didn't really read these contracts, so I signed everything. Is that how you
exactly? That's like what I did, what everybody else does.
And when did it dawn on you that, like, what did I do? How long did it take before you realized I may have signed on, but, I mean, it started off with not great reimbursements, but every year in my practice, the reimbursements dropped. Was that your experience too?
Absolutely. Every year. And then every time you have a contract come up for renewal, they're cutting you more, and they're cutting you right where you do the most work. And the first thing that you know, you're on a little treadmill like a hamster, and you're just running. You're running in place, just trying to survive. There's just almost no way to get off. You've got to see more and more patients, and you've got to do more and more requirements and get things, everything perfect, just to hope to get paid. And the crazy thing about our profession is you provide a service, and then you hope that somewhere down the road some unseen third-party payer is going to decide that they'll even pay you what they agreed to, and every year that amount is less. So it just becomes a horrible circle where you're chasing your tail and you never can catch up again.
And it gets even worse because you know you're getting a smaller reimbursement, but when we've tried to, you know, finally say, I want to see my contract, I want to read it, and I want the reimbursement fee scale, they wouldn't give it to us. So, I mean, they would, well, you can't have it, or you can have just five codes at a time. So
right.
It became this, well, I can't sign a contract unless I know what you're going to pay me. And it was like this runaround. It was
Absolutely.
Like pulling teeth from these guys.
Absolutely. They don't want you to have a clue what they're going to pay you. And then in our specialty, as you're aware, many times we do multiple procedures where you'll do surgery on both sides of someone's nose, or you'll do both ears, or you'll do something on both sides of the neck. And the next thing that came down the pike was that they started paying you less for everything else that you did, and a lot of the insurance companies would say, okay, we're going to pay you 100% of whatever we allow for the first thing you do, and then the 50% for the second, and then we're going to pay you 25% or nothing for everything you do after that. So if you're operating on somebody's sinuses and they've got eight sinuses, four on each side, you got paid for the first sinus on the left side, half the first sinus on the right side, and nothing after that. And the crazy thing is, the closer you get to somebody's brain and the closer you get back to their optic nerves in the back of their nose and in the center of their head, you're getting paid nothing for being there in the most dangerous area, one of the most dangerous areas of the body, simply because they say, you're already there, you can do it for free.
And, exactly.
And you just get to where you can't do it anymore.
Oh, it's incidental. Like, you have to bypass the area that you're operating in just to get where you are, so we're not going to pay for the first part of it.
Right. You spend an hour getting to where you're going to operate, and they say, oh, that's free just to get there, and then once you got there, we'll pay you a little bit once you get there. So it just became ridiculous.
And what people don't realize, when you say 100% of the allowed amount, that's already a discounted amount.
Absolutely, and they set that amount. So they're allowable in what you charge. That's one of the things that so many people don't understand. They think, well, all the doctor has to do is increase his or her prices and offset things. But it's not like going to the grocery store and buying milk. You can charge $100 for something that you do, and if the insurance company says, no, all we allow for that is $5, then that's all you're going to get paid. No matter, you can charge $5,000, and you're going to get paid $5. So, yes, that's what people don't understand, is that what doctors charge is totally irrelevant in the way that our system works today.
And you can't balance bills. So if you get the $5, you can't get the $95 from the patient.
Absolutely not, because you've signed your contract that says you won't charge that person any more than the allowable. And then you take it one step further, you're trying to get your $5, and the insurance company has somebody sitting there at a desk that is reviewing your chart and says, you know, this doctor didn't dot this I or didn't cross this T, so we're just not going to pay him anything and say this bill, that this whole claim is rejected. Mm-hmm. And then you spend the next 6 months trying to collect your $5, and that just gets to where it's too expensive to do.
Absolutely. And then the flip side is you go through all the pre-certifications and the approval process, you do the surgery, you actually get paid, and then they come after you after they paid you and said, oh, we made a mistake, we want our money back.
Absolutely. And from their standpoint, if you make a mistake, you're completely liable. But if they make a mistake, they'll just tell you, oh, no, that's human error, that's in your contract. Our person made a mistake and said that we would pay you for this surgery or for this service, and now 3 months later we've decided we're not going to pay for that, so the next time we do pay you, we're just going to deduct that amount from your check 3 months from now.
Now, we're talking about commercial insurance. You were on Medicaid and Medicare initially, correct?
Uh-huh, I was.
What was your experience with them? I remember seeing Medicaid patients and then never getting paid. And
uh-huh.
We were, I don't know, it's an anecdotal story, but we were told that out of 10 claims, they may just pitch 8 of them or 9 of them and
uh-huh.
just and then make you resubmit them, just arbitrarily.
Yes, I think that's exactly what goes on here as well. And I think that they just pick out a certain number and say, okay, we're going to hold these up. And I think that it happens routinely all the time.
Mm. There's no advocate for the doctor. I want to ask you this too, because I've been on shows and I've made this comment and people are so taken aback, it's as if it could never happen. If you don't get paid, from my experience and from what my accountant says, you can't write it off because you never got paid it, so it's not part of your intake. It's you just have to eat that particular bad debt. Is that what you do as well?
Absolutely. And I think that's another scam in our system. That anything that you do that you don't get paid for, you just eat it. You can turn it over to a collection agency, but chances are you're not going to get 5 cents on the dollar of what you would have got if the patient or if the insurance company would have paid you. So, yes, we have no recourse to be able to either write things off or provide free care where it can come off of our practice bottom line at any place. And I'm not sure why that's never been addressed, but we don't have that ability to do that.
I mean, I think we must be the only profession where you literally have to be forced to give free service, still be liable for the service that you provide.
Absolutely.
And then someone's telling you your value and setting your price. That's not even your profession. That doesn't make sense to me at all.
No, it makes absolutely no sense. And the only reason we're in the situation that we're in as physicians and secondarily because of that as patients is because sometime in the past we decided it would be okay to let some third-party payer get between us and the patient and start making payments. And that was, I think that was the biggest mistake that physicians ever made, was allowing third-party payers to do that to us.
On that comment, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
For years, Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center has been providing outstanding care to patients of all ages. They are dedicated to patient satisfaction and have been the recipient of the Georgia Otolaryngology Association Patient Satisfaction Award. They welcome any questions you may have about their services. Their practice includes treatment of asthma, allergies, sleep apnea, snoring, hearing impairments, and chronic sinus disease. Dr. Elena George is a board-certified ear, nose, and throat surgeon. Her training in New York has included training at Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She believes in practicing both the art and science of medicine. All patients are seen by Dr. George. All treatment options are discussed, and time will be spent to answer all questions. Their office is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road in Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, you can be confident that you are in good hands with their professional team.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Thank you and welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're getting an education about what it means to be a solo practitioner or basically a doctor in this society today. It's been a ton of PR that's a tsunami of PR against us, as if we just want to do procedures, we get paid if we order tests. All we care about is the bottom line and the dollar bill, and our patients be damned. That's what the media has said. That's what the government has said. And unfortunately, I think patients have started to believe that. You know, what's your experience with patients? I know that from my experience, the insurance companies have demonized us, and we're getting all sorts of statements from the patients that the insurance companies are making. Oh, I don't know why your doctor did that. They didn't have a right to charge you before, you know, they submitted your claim. All sorts of ridiculousness that put us at odds with our patients. Is that your experience too?
Yes, absolutely. The insurance company wants the patient to believe that the doctor is the problem. And in reality, I would say 99 times out of 100, the patient really has no idea what is going on with the bill and the payment. When a patient comes in to my clinic or comes in, I would presume, to your clinic, they may have we may cover 1,000 different plans, possible insurance plans, and maybe 100 of them are with Blue Cross and 50 of them with Aetna, et cetera. And when those patients come in and they've got a card, then we have to contact the insurance company. We spend anywhere from 5 minutes to an hour on the phone trying to talk to someone at this insurance company who says, yes, this person is covered, and here is the amount that they're supposed to pay a specialist on the day that they're there, and here's what their additional co-insurance and deductible will be. And so finally you get that information, and the patient has to pay anywhere from, say, $25 to $75 after the visit, and they leave. Mm-hmm. Well, then 6 weeks later or a month later, the insurance company sends out this EOB, which is the explanation of benefits, and come to find out everything they told you at the insurance company was wrong, and the patient owed you $100 more that day, mm-hmm. or the patient owed you $20 less. And when it really gets complicated is when the insurance company says, oh, the doctor overcharged you by $20. And then this irate patient calls in because they think that you're a rich doctor who charged them $20 over and you're committing insurance fraud simply because your secretary at the front desk did exactly what a representative on the telephone told them to do. But you're always the guy or the gal in the middle who's made to look bad by this written letter and EOB from the insurance company.
It's sad, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
And then the other, if you do a procedure like a telescopic examination, and it's one of the bigger ticket items that you do as an ENT, mm-hmm. and they say, oh, it's all part of the copay, and then they end up with a bigger bill, the more than the $100 that you described, and
right.
it's not appropriate. I mean,
yeah, and so the patient what the patient does is find, and you find out later is, well, what we approved was the visit. We didn't approve a procedure, and that all goes against the patient's deductible. And so, yeah, then the patient finds out, you mean I had to pay you $125 that day instead of my $5 copay, and then they're irate once again, saying, oh, this doctor just did this to just so they can get some more money. And or the flip side of that is you see a patient and you do an endoscopy while they're there, and then the insurance company says, oh, no, we just figure that's all part of the visit. You had to do that anyway to see them. But what they don't tell the patient is they paid the primary care doctor next door the exact same amount that they paid you when he or she saw the patient and said, I don't know what this is. I'm going to send you next door to the ear, nose, and throat doctor. And so they paid the primary care doctor the exact same thing as they paid you, even though you did an endoscopy and brought a tremendous amount of expertise additionally to the table.
Let's talk about specialists, because that's another – we get a extremely bad rap.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you just said a mouthful. We get paid now under Medicare guidelines – I think it's maybe 3 years now that we've been into this – that they don't pay specialists for consultations. They're no longer paid at a differential rate. So everybody's paid at the same rate, although we're not performing the same type of service.
Absolutely.
And that's and another thing that Medicare does is it sets the standard for commercial insurances. So by definition, specialists, you know, their income is dropped, because when you do a consult, it's just an office visit now.
That's right. So if a physician sends you a patient, let's say that you saw Mrs. Jones 2 years and 11 months and 30 days ago, you saw Mrs. Jones for a nosebleed. And then now, fast forward to almost 3 years later, another specialist across, another primary care doctor across town send Mrs. Jones back to you because she has a mass in her neck. And so you spend 45 minutes seeing Mrs. Jones, doing a complete evaluation, and maybe even do a needle biopsy, and then you send in a bill to Medicare for a consult or a new patient visit, and then they send you a note back saying, sorry, we're not going to pay you that $90 we had allowed for a new patient visit. You saw Ms. Jones less than 3 years ago, so we're going to pay you $39 for today's visit, and that happens all the time.
And it doesn't take into account what you had to spend to see Mrs. Jones, the equipment, the, you know, the tools to perform the biopsy.
That's correct.
I mean, this is the one thing that, again, I don't think patients have any concept of. We're running businesses. We don't have anybody subsidizing our cost of doing business.
Absolutely.
So, and that's gone up. I know malpractice has gone up. The rent goes up. Your salaries for your employees go up. Everything goes up, but your reimbursement goes down.
Your reimbursement goes down. That's correct. And I would venture a guess that most specialists, even if they're in a small private office like myself, it probably costs, I don't know what you would say, but I imagine it costs between $800 and $1,100 a day just to have the doors open and just to pay your overhead to be able to provide a service.
Yeah, that would sum it up. And if you're in the city, you know, big city, it's even worse.
If you divide that up, you say, okay, let's put it at an even amount. Let's say it costs $1,000 to be able to provide services that day. And you're in your clinic for 8 hours, and you collect $50 per patient. How many patients you got to see that day? You've got to see 20 patients to even cover your overhead if you collect $50 that day. Now, if you extrapolate that and you say, well, not only that, I've got to spend the money to send all these bills in, then I've got to fight to get my $50, and I might get my $50 6 months from now, then you see where the problem comes up. And patients don't understand that at all, that you've got to see 20 or 30 patients just to break even that day. And that is if you get paid what the insurance companies and Medicare have said that they would pay you.
And you're still not even getting a majority of your money, because you have to actually, even if you get paid, you're waiting for it. So
that's
it's not
right
at the time of service. It's maybe a $10, $20, $50 copay that you're actually receiving.
That's
and then
right.
You're hopeful that they're going to pay it. I mean, let's also talk about the fact that despite having all of these pressures of volume, that takes away from the doctor-patient relationship. I mean, I'm able, unfortunately, to spend half an hour, 45 minutes with my patients because I choose not to do that style of medicine. But how many doctors, how many of your colleagues have you known that had to hire extenders, you know, PAs, nurse practitioners, just to get the 20 people in or 30
many
people?
Many of them. many of them, I'm one of the few doctors out there anymore, at least in my area, that doesn't have a physician extender.
Mm-hmm.
And it's simply so that you can turn more patients through and hope that you can tread water. So you hire the physician extender so that hopefully they will send up patients that you can cover your practice expenses, and then maybe as a physician you can select out the patients that you're going to see that you know you have to see, so that you can collect on those as well and hopefully provide a little better care to those more complicated patients. But I have stonewalled, and I have no plans whatsoever ever to hire a physician extender, and I'll tell you why. As a specialist, I have had referring physicians who are primary care doctors tell me at lunch and over the telephone that one of the things that they absolutely detest is to send one of their patients to see a specialist, and they get to the specialist and they see a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner, and the primary care doctor says, you know, I'm better trained than that person. Why would I have sent them to see a specialist so I could get a note back from a nurse practitioner at that specialist's office? So that is my number one reason for not hiring a physician extender.
I think that's an excellent reason. And I've noticed that the scope of practice for both nurse practitioners and physician assistants has only gotten larger. I mean, I remember when they first started back in the mid-90s,
uh-huh.
and it was they were coming after the doctor to
yes.
maybe just make sure that the patient had their instruction sheet, or it was just kind of an add-on visit,
uh-huh.
you know, it's part of the visit. Now they are the front line, and the doctor comes in and signs a prescription in some practices.
Absolutely.
It's completely vice versa.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe in it personally, and I know that you take – must take call in the ER or have consultations in the hospital. How many of those have you gotten from a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant, and they didn't understand why they were consulting you, or it was completely inappropriate to consult ENT because they just didn't understand the pathophysiology of something?
Oh, a vast majority of them. And here's the problem with it. What we have done is we have decided we're going to, as a nation, we're going to train people who are not physicians to act as physicians. And so what happens is they have these protocols that they follow. And they follow this protocol along. They say, well, here's what this patient has, and I'm going to do this and give them this medicine and order this study and this study and this study. And then based on what this finds, they'll make a specialty referral. The problem is with all of those things based on a protocol is it assumes that the diagnosis is correct to begin with. And that's what you're saying. Most of the time, the diagnosis is not correct. And so you're off base from the very beginning. And so one of the classic things I see from physician extenders is somebody that comes in with a thyroid mass. And what typically happens is they go in to see their primary care doctor. They're seen by a physician extender, and they're complaining of something like mucus in their throat, or when they swallow, it feels like a lump down there. So what happens is they get a thyroid ultrasound, and it shows a 3-millimeter nodule. And then they do a thyroid uptake scan, which shows nothing. And then they do thyroid blood studies, which is normal. And then they send the patient to me for this 3-millimeter thyroid nodule, and it's absolutely nothing. You don't need to do anything about it. And what the patient really had was they had reflux from their stomach coming up in their throat, and it was causing mucus, and all they need is a pill to fix the problem. And that's probably the most common one that I see, that where you have a $20,000 evaluation by someone who's not a physician for a problem that doesn't exist. And that happens all the time.
With that, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that dizziness may be a sign of heart disease, iron deficiency, high or low blood pressure, low blood sugar, or an inner ear infection? Dizziness can take the form of a spinning sensation, also known as vertigo, or a feeling of lightheadedness. The individual can also feel faint or have a rapid heartbeat. If you take high blood pressure medication, remember to take the medication daily as directed to control your blood pressure. Diabetics must remember to eat after taking their medication and to eat at regular intervals. If you have anemia, make sure to take a multivitamin that contains iron and to eat vegetables such as spinach. Dizziness after a cold or flu may be due to a virus. If you have dizziness, it is important to see your doctor for a complete physical examination. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
FollowSniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
FollowSniffles.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
So many kids in Arkansas on Medicaid, but I can see a time coming soon when they're going to say, okay, if you don't do Medicare and you don't do Obamacare, then you can't do Medicaid either. And so that's coming pretty quick, I'm sure.
I don't doubt that. I think also they're going to tie it to our licensure.
Yeah, I think that's what they're going to try to do.
I think the mindset now, I've been hearing this in rumblings, that healthcare is a right, and therefore doctors should be forced to provide a service.
Yep. Yes, I think that's the case.
Well, where are your colleagues? I don't see anybody. Well, there's a few. AAPS is one group, physicians for patient care. But on average, when you go for lunch and you're talking to your doctor colleagues, are they upset? Are they demoralized? What's going on with them? They just sit here and go, okay.
Yeah, they're demoralized. They're scared to death. They're not going to be able to make their country club payment the next month, or their double mortgage on their house, or their kids' private school payment. And so they just keep letting third-party payers and Medicare just beat them down to nothing. And then when they get to where they're just totally demoralized, they sell out to a hospital for a two-year salary and hope that they can 2 years later renegotiate for enough money to pay all their bills.
And I don't believe that's going to happen.
I don't either.
I've had a doctor on a couple years ago who said, in her opinion, after the doctors got their quota of doctors on staff, that they would basically, once they had them captive, lower their payment and make them work harder.
Absolutely. That's all that can happen. And because if you think about the huge structure of medicine in this country, it's basically the doctor, everybody in between, and the patient. And everybody in between has to get a cut of the money before the patient gets their care and the doctor gets paid. And the bigger these organizations become, the more people there are in between that have to get paid. We call them high-heeled nurses and administrators, but all those people have to get paid. And it's just a travesty.
And what that does in actuality is takes away the money from patient care.
Yes.
The people who come out on the short end of the stick are the people who we're supposed to be for.
That's
the
right.
Doctors and the patients. And
that's right.
They're the least empowered in all of this.
Absolutely.
And I was on a show last night, and I said that I was asked, what do you think is going to change? Do you think Obamacare is going to change anything? And what would be your prescription? And I said, the first thing that doctors and patients both have to do is to want more, to value themselves.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know that you stopped taking Medicare, and uh-huh. I'm going to ask you more about what you're doing now, because you felt, I'm more valuable than this. You know,
yes.
I want
yes.
to be a doctor. I don't want to be an agent of the government.
Yeah, I don't want to be a provider, a nameless provider.
Yeah, I really used to not even think about that term. Now I find it completely offensive.
The provider?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I detest getting a letter that says, Dear Provider. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about, I think we've explored enough why somebody would be really just disempowered and disenfranchised and just demoralized by being in an insurance system. What was the final straw that made you say enough? What happened?
Well, several things, I think. The first was just watching the reimbursements go down. The second was seeing the government step in with Obamacare and try to force that down our throats. And then the final thing was seeing ICD-10 come out next October. And you know, that's just going to be a disaster, and I want to be as far away from ICD-10 as I can get. I don't know if you're probably in our academy, and the academy sent out a letter a few months ago that said, hey, you better have 6 months of expenses that you borrow because you're not going to get paid for 6 months after ICD-10 starts because everything will be so screwed up. And I just made the decision, you know what, I'm going to try to get out as much as I can from underneath it before it goes over next October.
And I still need to really think, you know, implement this in my system. I mean, I have electronic medical records, et cetera. Uh-huh. But this applies to physicians as well as to hospitals, correct?
Absolutely. Uh-huh.
So they're not going to stage or roll it out in stages where the hospitals are going to have to implement it first?
No, I think it's all going to go through at the same time, isn't it?
I'm not sure. I've heard two versions of it, and I've been dragging my feet on doing it because I think it's just so ridiculous. I mean,
yeah.
140,000 codes with somebody
Absolutely.
Told me.
Absolutely.
They have a code for if you get hit by a military plane if in mid-air collision versus a commercial airline.
Right.
That's how stupid this is.
That's right. And look at the expense it takes. You know, I probably got – I haven't added up the total number, but I bet in the last 10 years I've spent $85,000 just on software and computers and keeping my software updated, you know.
Yeah.
My software packages for my electronic medical records and for my practice management, and then I paid – $300 a month just so I can have it, and then, you know, every year it's another $2,000 for the license renewal, and it's only going to get worse, not better.
And it doesn't improve health care.
Absolutely not.
Takes you away from your patient.
It makes it worse.
It does.
It makes it worse because you're having to check all these boxes and dictate all this information into areas that don't matter at all.
Let's talk about meaningful use, because that's another big black box that sounds, when they present it in their PR campaign, that it makes doctors more accountable and gives more information. But what does that mean on the front line for meaningful use?
It just means more things that you have to do. All it is forcing you to show that you're doing something that means nothing between you and the patient, and it's just added expenses on the physician to provide those things, and there's going to be no end to the meaningful use and the PQRS, and I can't keep straight all of these acronyms that the government insurance companies have come up with, which basically are more requirements for the physician to spend less time with the patient, which forces the physician to see fewer patients in a day, which allows the system to pay out less money. And so it's all really just a way of limiting care and giving bureaucrats outside of the physician-patient exam room access to information that they really shouldn't have in the first place.
And they do have information on everything that we do, what prescriptions we write,
right,
what the diagnosis is. And I wrote about this a couple years ago now. My fear on this electronic medical record scheme when everybody went online was that your information, I already know that when we write a prescription, the drug reps know what we write. And I know that the insurance companies know, because when people were getting new insurances, it would come up they were on a blood pressure medicine or something, and they would get dinged, even if they didn't put that in their paperwork, that they had high blood pressure, and they may not have. That was already known by the insurance companies.
Yes.
Now, if you take that to the next step, politically speaking, because there's a big push to, you know, keep people with any kind of mental illness from getting a gun. And my thought was, suppose you give a patient Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant, to stop smoking, and it ends up in their record, and it's not for depression, but the system would only see the Wellbutrin and then say, that's tied to depression.
How would
that affect someone getting a job, being able to have a gun legally? It's just this massive information, metadata, that's personal, that we don't control anymore. The doctor and the patient no longer could control.
That's right. And I don't think patients understand that everything now that's put into the medical record is accessible to anybody out there that that wants to look at it. And I am absolutely dead set against that. And that's one of the reasons that I have made the decision to get out of government medicine and eventually to get out of insured third-party payer insurance medicine as well. It's because I don't want somebody to be able to come in, either to walk into my office physically or to log in remotely and get between myself and my patients anymore. I'm just sick of that, and even the thought of it getting worse is scary to me. And so now, since I have opted out of the Medicare system, and I'm out of several insurance plans because my only choice was either you see these patients in this insurance plan and see Obamacare, or you can't see any of them. So I said, well, I don't want to see any of them then. But when those patients come in and see me now, they pay me cash, and anything that I say, anything that I write down, anything they say is confidential again. Nobody can come in and say, we want to look at those records, because they're not involved in the process anymore, and that is a very gratifying and good feeling to know that you've gone outside the system and that nobody can get between you again.
Now, how does that – I don't want to be in part of Obamacare at all. Mm-hmm. How did that present to you, that you knew that Obamacare was tied to those insurances? Was it they were Medicaid? What were they that you knew that you just stopped taking Obama-based insurance?
Well, here in Arkansas, in my area, we've got a draw. We probably, unlike probably where you are, we have a fairly small patient population. I think that my draw area is probably about 300,000 to 400,000 people. In this area, Blue Cross Blue Shield and QualChoice contracted with the federal government and said, okay, we will take your Obamacare money and we will insure these patients. Well, what they did was they took the Obamacare patients in the three plans, the bronze, the silver, and the platinum, or whatever it is, and they rolled it into their biggest PPO here in the state, okay? So what they did was they rolled it into the Blue Cross, Blue Shield, True Blue PPO and said, if you want to see these patients, continue seeing your Blue Cross, True Blue PPO patients, then you have to agree to see Obamacare patients and Medicaid. They're rolling Medicaid into that plan too. But we're going to pay you as a specialist 25% less than you get paid for anybody else. And if you don't agree to do that, you have to send us a registered letter to get out of the plan. So what they've done is, if you're a physician in the state of Arkansas, and if you don't read your contracts well, and if you don't look at all of the multitude of information they send you every week, they've just hidden an announcement in your paperwork. You never saw it, and so you're automatically signed up to be an Obamacare doctor and see any Medicaid patient that's rolled into Obamacare with those plans. Now, when the patient walks in your office, it doesn't matter if they're the CEO of a company and they have True Blue PPO, they've got the same card, the same insurance Blue Cross Blue Shield card as the patient who has an Obamacare plan or the patient who has Medicaid that's enrolled into Obamacare. They get the same card. So you don't know. All you do is you see them, and then down the road, you find out you got paid another 25% less, and that they were part of Blue Cross Blue Shield's Obamacare/Medicaid network.
That's very rude.
Yes, and so that's what they forced physicians to do. And unfortunately, here in Arkansas, I don't know what the statewide average is, but here in Hot Springs, I would say that 80% of the physicians now have sold their practices and are owned by the hospitals. Well, those physicians never see their paperwork. There's somebody in a business office opening all their mail, reading all those letters, and they just let it slide. They never tell the doctors anything. All the doctors do is come to work every morning, get on their little hamster treadmill, run until they get off and go home, and they don't really know what's happening to them.
That's incredible.
Yep.
So if you don't take Medicaid, because I'm no longer a provider, I don't think you are either at this point, correct?
Of Medicare. I'm still taking Medicaid, but okay. Not Medicare.
But if you, I don't do either, so if you weren't part of Medicaid, could you even see these Blue Cross Blue Shield patients as far as you can determine?
You probably couldn't.
Wow.
So that would probably be another way of getting you out. But from their standpoint, that's a great thing. That from the insurance company's standpoint and from
free.
The federal government, it's just limiting their networks further.
Exactly. So you saw them for free. And ultimately what's happening, and I'm not going to take a break on this. I just want to keep going. With this, you live in an interesting microcosm because most of the doctors are actually employees now. So they're not in the solo or in the independent physician pool. Now that you're out of that loop, I mean, you still admit to the hospitals and you still have ability to see patients in the hospital. Is that still the case?
Yes, that's correct.
But when you see patients in your office and you're charging them this, and I see that your prices are actually online for every service that you offer, are you finding that people are coming to you because, hey, that's not too expensive and I don't have to wait and I can see a doctor? Is that happening?
Yes, that's exactly what they're doing. What happens is they call, and to see their network doctor, it's going to take 60 to 90 days to see them in some cases. They call me, and I see them this afternoon or tomorrow morning. And so, yes, that's happening. The biggest problem with it, though, Dr. George, is getting patients educated about what is available. And they don't understand that they don't have a concept of how the charges are set up. When they see somebody doesn't take Medicare or somebody's out of network, they think that everything is out of their pocket. They don't understand that the doctor bill is a very small percentage of everything they encounter. The doctor is not the lab bill. The doctor is not the MRI bill. The doctor is not the hospital bill. And so it's a hard thing to educate your patients and to educate the public that just because I'm out of network with Medicare or out of network with your insurance company doesn't mean that the insurance is not going to pay your hospital bill if I put you in the hospital.
Okay.
Because the hospital is still in network with their plan.
And also if you send them for blood work or a CT scan, that's also going to be paid for by their insurance.
That's correct. And some insurances have now started doing what we call in-network and out-of-network benefits because they're trying to force patients to still go to the in-network doctors because those are the doctors that the hospital they contract with own, and they're trying to force all the patients to see those physicians. But now, let's say for Medicare, if you have Medicare and you come see me as an opted-out Medicare physician, all that I'm doing is opting out of Medicare payment to me. So I'm still in the Medicare system. Mm-hmm. I can order tests. I can order CAT scans. I can admit you to the hospital. I can operate on you. And that's a different part of Medicare paying all of those bills. All that comes out of the Medicare patient's pocket is what I charge them and we agree upon. And that's part of the beauty of the system. If you see somebody and if you're a physician and you are contracted with Medicare or with the insurance company, you have to charge, by law, you have to charge what that insurance company says you can charge. But now that I'm outside of the system, if a Medicare patient comes in to see me, I can charge them whatever I want. I can list a price of $100, but if I want to, I can charge them $40. Or they can bring me a dozen eggs and say, Doc, will you take 12 eggs to see me today? And I can say, yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am. Mm-hmm. And it's totally legal for me to do that now. And that's a beautiful thing.
So that's the ultimate sliding scale.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's patient-based.
That's right. That's right. And when a patient is paying for their care, not a third-party middleman, they're much more involved, and they appreciate what you do because you looked them in the eye and said, this is the service I'm providing you, and here's what it's going to cost you. And once you get over that hump of being kind of embarrassed to do that, the world just kind of opens up to you with your patient care.
I think it's freedom. It's
yes, it is.
Literally, I mean, you must look, get up in the morning now and go, I want to go to work. I'm looking forward to it.
That's right. The first thing I do is look at my schedule and see how many self-pay patients I've got on my list that are paying me out of their pocket because those are now my favorite patients, even though they're paying me significantly less than the insurance company may be paying me for the same procedure and the same services.
But maybe
because
not.
They're my favorite patients now.
But actually, they're probably paying you more because by the time you submit your bill, your claim, get denied, have to work it, or the flip side, get paid and then recoup it back,
yes.
You probably did get paid more.
Yes. In the long run, you're absolutely correct. You're going to get paid more by seeing patients out of network and for cash, and in the long run, the patient is going to pay less by seeking out doctors that are willing to do that.
Let's also talk about the quality of care. I mean, you're talking about the person who knows the most about your problem being able to diagnose it correctly and fix it and not send you for a billion tests.
Uh-huh.
And still end up not knowing what they're doing, put you on perhaps the wrong type of medication and making errors. So it's a cost to the patient. You kind of get what you pay for.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And the way the system is set up and has been set up over the last 25 to 30 years is exactly that. It's a tiered system where people start at the bottom and they work their way up to a specialist. And so very frequently, if the patient could have seen the specialist first and bypassed the rest of the system, there would have been much, much less expense in getting to the diagnosis, because that's what the specialist sees and does all day, every day. And so an illustration would be that if somebody came into me and they were having chest pain and their heart was beating erratically and I saw them and I listened to their heart, I can hear their heartbeat, and I understand maybe there's a problem there, but I'm clueless. So I send them to get an EKG. I send them to get an echocardiogram. I do all this blood work. But, and the insurance company pays me for doing all of that. But if that patient had, from the first step, gone to see their cardiologist, the cardiologist might have been able to tell from across the room what was going on, not prescribed one test, and just gone directly to one intervention, maybe a medication, to take care of the problem. Because that's what he or she does all day, every day. And our system is set up to where that's the last person that the patient sees, not the first person that the patient sees.
And under Obamacare, it doubles down because it's based on the managed care paradigm, where you have to go through a gatekeeper, a primary care physician, before you get your referral to a specialist. And I remember when it came online in the late 90s, because I graduated around the same time, people hated that. They wanted to come straight to the ENT or straight to the ophthalmologist, and they were given treatment longer than they needed to have it. They were worse when they finally got referred. And it was just a disaster. This is going to be, to me, a million times worse.
Yes, I think that it will. And basically, what we're describing is socialized medicine. And that's where we're headed, just as fast as we can get there. With Obamacare, or if you want to call it that, the Affordable Care Act.
Do you think that it's a Trojan horse for single payer?
Yeah, I do. If the whole system collapses, then the single payer on the white horse comes riding in to save the day. But unfortunately, I think we're headed towards a two-tier system. I think we're headed towards a system where patients that can't afford to will pay for medical care out of their pocket, and patients that can't afford to will be shuttled into the single-payer socialistic-type system, and I think that's going to happen within the next few years unless we have some dramatic changes from the top down.
Or maybe the bottom up. I mean,
from the bottom up. But, you know, the problem is physicians like myself or yourself out there in our communities have said, okay, we've had enough, we're not going to do this anymore. For every one of us, there's 5,000 doctors that are just staying on the treadmill and hoping that if they just keep their head in the sand, that everything will work out and things will be okay in the future. And unfortunately, even though there's a few doctors around the country that have started stepping out, we've got a long way to go before we are a serious force in the free market economy.
I'm an optimist, and I say everybody who steps out is making a huge difference. And every patient that says, like, they go to your clinic and say, you know, Dr. Valeri was awesome, and I only had to pay $90 for my office visit, my first office visit. And I noticed that you actually have roll charges so that if you need to have your first visit and you need a telescopic examination, it's one fee.
Uh-huh.
Right? And it's greatly discounted.
Yes.
I mean, even if the patient paid insurance, they'd actually pay more than paying cash to you.
That's right. And so those patients that are out of network, that's the ones that are the best ones for me to see now. Because if they come in and they've got a $2,500 deductible, and I have to charge them, say, $285 for an endoscopy and office visit that day, If they don't, if they're out of network, all they get charged is $100 to $125. Hmm. And so, yes, it's much cheaper out of their pocket to go out of network to see me.
And this is about consumerism and free market, basically.
I mean,
it's distilled just down to that. You see a doctor immediately, you pay less, and you get better value. It's a no-brainer.
That's right, except that the hospitals are in bed with the insurance companies and the federal government to try to come up with ways to force those patients to still stay inside the expensive system and keep using the same system they were before. And part of that is through criticizing physicians. Part of that is through making sure that your patients that are in these healthcare plans are not educated about what their options actually are, and to just scare them to death that they're going to have a $100,000 hospital bill, when you and I both know that it may be $5,000 the actual cost, but the patient thinks, oh my goodness, if I go outside the system, it's going to cost me $100,000.
Exactly, it's a big PR scam.
Yes,
they've done a masterful job of making them seem that the only game in town, and that if you don't have health insurance, you're going to die.
That's right.
Have you heard of things like the health sharing ministries, like Liberty Health Share?
Yes, I have. I've been on their website and have read quite a bit there.
Is that something that you encourage your patients to get into? Because to me, that's the same as fee for service, but because I'm getting paid and the patient's not coming out.
I have given several patients the name of those companies. And especially the one, is it Liberty, the one that's outside, kind of outside, that you don't have to profess to a certain religious orientation? All you have to do is agree with their principles.
Exactly, that's
the
one. Yeah,
that's the one that I've been referring my patients to.
Well, I'm just really honored to have you on the show today, because it's sometimes you feel like you're the only one who thinks this way. And you're like, you get it, and I get it. I want to make sure that anything that we can do to work together to expand our ability to educate patients, I definitely want to make sure that we stay in touch so we can do that.
Absolutely. I'm happy to do that. And anytime you've got a blank spot and you need somebody to talk to, just give me a call. I'll be happy to visit with you again.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Hey, well, how can people reach you?
My website is SamuelValerieMD.com. SamuelValerieMD.com is the best way to reach us.
And you have a blog too, don't you?
Yes, I've got a blog on my website there, and across the top of the website, it's set up to where people can see what our cash prices are here in the clinic and what my cash prices for surgery are, and they can also access my blog there, and I've also got a page there that's detailed information from my Medicare patients and out-of-network patients explaining what I've done and why I've done it, so they can access all of that through SamuelValerieMD.com.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, and I want to thank my listeners for tuning in. Dr. Valerie, if you can just stay on the line after we come off the show, I just want to touch base with you for 1 second.
Okay, yes, ma'am. I'll be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.